Hello, and welcome to the Story of Singapore, Episode 5, Sugar, Spice, and Everything Not So Nice. In 1481, a new Portuguese king rose to the throne, seeking to introduce a list of reforms to his regime to break the crown's dependence on other Portuguese aristocrats. However, with the kingdom facing bankruptcy, he needed to build up his royal treasury before he could fully pursue his goals. So, he turned his gaze towards the lucrative spice trade. For the past few hundred years, the Republic of Venice had been colluding with Arabian and Egyptian trading ports in the Mediterranean Sea to secure a monopoly over the spice trade in Europe. Although prices for spices were greatly inflated, demand remained high because they were used in medicine, food, religion, and perfumery. The rich were willing to pay good money for these products. So, the king commissioned several expeditions to bypass the Venetian monopoly and establish a new and direct trade route between Portugal and the closest spice center, India. Of course, Portugal was not the only one looking to do so. In 1492, its Spanish rival appointed a certain Christopher Columbus to sail across the Atlantic Ocean to reach India. As you know, Columbus would make landfall on a different continent altogether, mistaking the Americas for the Indies, which was how the controversial terminology of American Indians came about. Anyway, before Columbus acquired the funding for his little adventure from Spain, he had approached Portugal earlier with the same proposal. However, the Portuguese king and his advisors predicted that Columbus's journey across the Atlantic Ocean to India would be significantly longer than the estimate that Columbus was giving. So, they rejected his proposal in favor of a different route, the one along the African coastline. In 1497, Portuguese sailors set off along that route to reach India, and for the first time in world history, succeeded in their quest. The discovery of the Americas and the maritime circumnavigation of Africa by the Europeans were events so monumental that they would usher in the Age of Discovery, going on to dictate power dynamics across the globe in the centuries to come. Shortly after, Portugal would sever pre-existing Venetian and Egyptian supply routes by establishing colonies along the maritime trade routes in the Indian Ocean. For a period, Portugal would become the new spice monopolist, but new entrants would soon join the game of exploration, and these European powers would be racing one another to colonize the world. For now, let us return to our home ground. In the previous episode, we followed the history of Southeast Asia, from the Indianization of agrarian kingdoms around 500 BCE to the rise and fall of maritime powerhouses in the 1400s. The last part of this episode may feel a little rushed because the episode was already stretching 30 minutes, so I could not go through the events as thoroughly as I would have preferred. You may also notice that I paid more attention to the polities in the Malay archipelago as opposed to those in the Indo-Chinese peninsula. That is simply because Singapore is located in the heart of the Malay archipelago. While polities in the Indo-Chinese peninsula might have exerted some form of influence, they would not have been as powerful as those closer to home. Regardless, I must say that they are all fascinating pieces of history. I am unable to dive in too deep because certain parts of history have been lost to time, while others remain fragmentary and debated even among scholars. Plus, this is the story of Singapore. If you wish to know more, I highly encourage you to read up on the many, many polities in Southeast Asian history. They are indeed fascinating. For now, the Malacca Sultanate was rising to become the dominant power in the Malay archipelago. Its diplomatic alliance with China provided much-needed economic and military support in its founding years. The city's prime position also allowed the Malaccans to wrestle control over the all-important Strait of Malacca away from its Javanese rival, the Majapahit Empire. It had been on the decline due to conflicts over succession of the throne. Adding fuel to the fire was the adoption of Islam by the increasingly powerful Malacca Sultanate, accelerating the transformation of the Hindu-Buddhist culture of the Malay world into an Islamic one. Majapahit emperors, whose legitimacy was predicated on Hindu-Buddhist norms, were quickly losing influence over a population that was turning into Muslims. Meanwhile in China, the tides were shifting. The death of the reigning Chinese emperor in 1424 marked a change in China's foreign relations with Southeast Asia. Subsequent emperors took on an increasingly isolationist posture and began pulling the plug on intervention efforts in foreign politics. Though the Malacca Sultanate did continue to maintain friendly relations with the Chinese bureaucracy. Soon after, the famous expeditionary treasure voyages commanded by the Chinese eunuch and admiral Zheng He were discontinued. I've neglected to mention his name last episode too, but he is a particularly significant and popular figure in Asian history. As tempted as I may be, I will have to stay on task and skip him. By this time, the Malacca Sultanate had become militarily self-sufficient. Though it briefly experienced a succession conflict, victories against the Siamese invasion forces from the Ayutthaya Kingdom secured the political legitimacy of its new sultan and established the Sultanate's reputation in Southeast Asia as a force to be reckoned. By the mid-1400s, the Malacca Sultanate entered its golden age. The sultans that followed pursued expansionist policies, taking over territories in Sumatra that formerly belonged to the Majapahit Empire. As the 1400s gave way to the 1500s, the worlds of East and West were about to collide. Keen to gather more information on the Chinese and to establish trade with the Malacca Sultanate, the Portuguese king dispatched a delegation to the city in 1508. There, the Portuguese envoys met with the Chinese merchant community, who then arranged the meeting between the Portuguese and the current ruler of Malacca, Sultan Mahmud. The negotiations went smoothly, with the Sultan granting permission for the Portuguese to establish a trading post and even generously allocating a vacant building for them. On the other hand, the Muslim merchant communities were not having it. Having known about Portuguese exploits in India and wary of the threat that the Christian Europeans posed to their interests, the highly influential Muslim merchants persuaded the Sultan to betray and capture the Portuguese instead. While Sultan Mahmud was all smiles and laughter with the Portuguese, word of the conspiracy reached the ears of the delegation. The envoys, however, were so convinced of the Sultan's hospitality that they dismissed the rumours entirely. Disguised as trading vessels, the Malaccan fleet ambushed the Portuguese ships. The Portuguese managed to repel every boarding attempt, but heavily outnumbered by the Malaccans, they were unable to land any troops to rescue those stuck in the city. The Portuguese delegation retreated to India, but not before sending the bodies of two captives, each with an arrow through his skull, as a warning to the Sultan should any harm come to the remaining Portuguese stranded in the city. Whether the Sultan knew it or not, war was coming. 2 years later, on the 1st of July 1511, a Portuguese armada under the personal command of the governor of Portuguese India, Afonso de Albuquerque, arrived in the harbour of Malacca and unleashed salvo fire to bombard the city. Yes, we are now at the part of history where swords, spears, and bows are progressively being phased out by matchlocks, pikes, and cannons. Albuquerque's contingent was about 1,000 men strong, but based on informants within the city, Sultan Mahmud could muster a combined army 20 times larger. However, Albuquerque had a few things going for him. With an effective blockade on the harbour, no ship could enter or leave the city without passing through the Portuguese armada. Without access to the sea, the Sultan's calls for reinforcements to his maritime allies would take a lot more time to be delivered. Furthermore, the Malacca Sultanate depended on the trade of food to feed its population because its lands were too salty and sandy to develop an agricultural industry. The Portuguese could effectively starve the city out. The two sides met at the negotiating table. Albuquerque demanded the immediate return of all Portuguese prisoners without ransom. But Sultan Mahmud deferred on the matter and instead tried to sue for peace. In truth, the Sultan was probably not too intimidated by the tiny size of the Portuguese armada and was simply buying time to organize the city's defenses and summon reinforcements. A few weeks of back and forth would pass before Albuquerque grew tired of the negotiation stalemate and ordered his ships to bombard the city once again. Shocked by the sudden response, Sultan Mahmud released the prisoners at once, and Albuquerque seized the opportunity to demand heavy reparations. The Sultan refused. Time was ticking, so Albuquerque made plans for an amphibious assault the following morning. On the morning of 25 July 1511, the Portuguese landed on the shores of Malacca. They swiftly neutralized the defending force and even repelled a counterattack led by Sultan Mahmud himself. However, Albuquerque soon discovered that his provisions were insufficient to sustain his exhausted troops, so he was forced to call off the attack and head back to the ships. In the process of retreat, the Portuguese set fire to the royal palace and mosque. On 15 August, a second assault was ordered. This time, however, Albuquerque committed his full might to take the city. Malaccan resistance was quickly crushed once again, and the Malacca Sultanate finally fell to the Portuguese. Sultan Mahmud and his remaining men collected whatever royal treasure they could gather and fled into the jungle. Now, we might imagine that the battle was won by the Portuguese purely due to the technological superiority of their gunpowder weaponry. On the contrary, the Malaccans also had access to these firearms too. It would seem all the more strange given that the Malaccans lost to the Portuguese because even without reinforcements, the defending city garrison was larger than the invading force. However, there were a few key factors that decimated Malaccan performance on the battlefield. Firstly, the Malaccans could not comprehend how the smooth ammunition of gunpowder weapons was supposed to kill a person. Firearms were only introduced to the Malaccans 2 years prior, so despite possessing a few thousand artillery pieces, only a tiny band of a few hundred mercenaries could effectively man the cannons. Furthermore, the Malaccans relied heavily on bows, javelins, and short, light weapons, which were ineffective against steel-plated armor and long, heavy weapons used by the Portuguese. Compounding on this was the fact that European powers like the Portuguese were just emerging from centuries of warfare in their continent. Their military formations and tactics were battle-tested, while the Moluccan troops never really had a need nor experience to develop that level of combat. In the meantime, Sultan Mahmud was riding it out in the jungles, waiting for the Portuguese to plunder the city and leave. Well, the governor of Portuguese India did call for a sacking of the city. But to leave the city, Albuquerque had no such plans. After all, the port city of Malacca was a key player in the maritime Silk Road. Keeping the city was instrumental for the Portuguese Empire to establish complete dominance over the spice industry in Europe. So, he commissioned the construction of a fortress that would hold a garrison of 500 men to defend the city. Sultan Mahmud's hopes to retake the city of Malacca were dashed. After several failed attempts, the exiled sultan eventually passed. He would leave behind two sons, who later established the Perak Sultanate and the Johor Sultanate. Keep your ears peeled for the Johor Sultanate, because when we finally return to Singapore in the next episode, it will come to play a crucial role. Albuquerque's capture of Malacca in 1511 was a new milestone in human history because, up until then, no one had ever conquered a territory this far from a power base. The long distance of Malacca from the nearest Portuguese stronghold meant that they could not retain the city through military occupation alone. Instead, they had to secure the loyalty of the local population by granting self-governance and the support of neighboring polities through diplomatic alliances to keep the city under Portuguese administration. With the city of Malacca as a strategic base, the Portuguese Empire could explore islands deeper into the Malay archipelago and begin to exert a zone of influence on Southeast Asia. China, on the other hand, was not at all happy about the fact that its longtime ally had just been deposed by a foreign power. When Portuguese envoys arrived in China to discuss trade relations, they were treated with hostility and later persecuted. As in the case with Malacca, the Portuguese Empire decided to open a trading post in China by force. But unlike Malacca, they were unable to make any grounds against the militarily stronger China. In 1554, a peace deal between the Portuguese and the Chinese was brokered. And after 3 years of improvements in their diplomatic relationship, Chinese authorities leased the city of Macau to the Portuguese. In the meantime, the Spanish Empire was looking to contest Portuguese trade operations in Asia. In the early 16th century, Spanish explorers successfully sailed across the Atlantic Ocean to South America, and then across the Pacific Ocean to the Philippines, and by 1565, the first Spanish colony in Southeast Asia was established. Apart from trade, the propagation of Christianity was a key agenda for both the Spanish and Portuguese empires, so the monarchies often sponsored missionaries to accompany exploration vessels, where they would preach Christianity and build churches in new colonies. While Spanish missionaries subsequently managed to convert the Filipino population, Portuguese missionaries were never quite able to overcome the inertia they faced from the Muslim Malaccan population. For the rest of the 16th century, the Portuguese Empire and the Spanish Empire were the only two colonial powers in Southeast Asia. However, the winds of fortune were quickly changing. Back in Europe, the Portuguese king was suddenly killed in battle, which sparked, you guessed it, a succession crisis. The king of the neighboring Spanish Empire responded by invading Portugal, combining both Spanish and Portuguese thrones under one rule. Even though Spain and Portugal were kept as legally distinct entities, the union meant that Spanish enemies, the English, French, and Dutch, now considered Portugal to be their enemy as well. Before I continue into the 17th century, I must bring up an important aspect about European trade in Asia. The success of previous voyages resulted in the formation of an increasing number of trade companies, which were sending ships to the spice markets in Asia to buy the spices, and returning with them to sell for a huge profit in Europe. Competition among these companies grew more and more intense, leading to an increase in price in Asia because more companies were buying spices, but also a decrease in price in Europe because more companies were selling spices. In other words, the costs had risen while profits had sunk. To counter the effects of competition, the English bureaucracy adopted an economic strategy in the year 1600 that brought their national resources together and invested them into a monopolistic enterprise called the East India Company. With competition outlawed in England, the partially state-owned company could keep its profitability very high while absorbing risks and losses without going bankrupt. Other European powers soon followed suit and established their very own monopolistic enterprises. These trading and colonial conglomerates would grow so powerful that they would come to have full militaries under their banners. In any case, in the early 17th century, the Dutch Empire expanded its emerging overseas venture and began harassing Portuguese colonies in Africa and Asia. In February 1603, the Dutch Empire exploited weak Portuguese presence in the Straits of Malacca and successfully captured a massive Portuguese merchant ship off the coast of Singapore with the aid of the Johor Sultanate. This would mark the beginning of formal diplomatic relations between the Dutch and the Johorians. The Portuguese considered bolstering security in the Straits of Malacca by building more fortresses along the coasts. But given the remoteness of the region, these were too expensive to build and maintain. Furthermore, the Portuguese Empire was now sharing resources with its Spanish counterpart, whose colonies were also being attacked by the Dutch and the English empires. Their finances were stretching thin. In October of the same year, a Portuguese armada was dispatched to deal with the pesky Dutch raiders. Off the Changi coast of Singapore, a naval battle ensued. The Dutch managed to incapacitate and sink the Portuguese flagship. The battle was won decisively in favor of the Dutch. Now in control of the waterway, the Dutch East India Company began deploying patrols in the region to plunder Portuguese trading ships, which had to resort to various tactics to evade Dutch privateers. By now, it was clear that the Portuguese Empire's grip on Southeast Asia was slipping. To facilitate its operations in the Malay archipelago, the Dutch East India Company shortlisted 6 possible locations in the region for a permanent base. A decision was made, and in 1619, the Dutch colonized the port city of Sunda Kelapa, renaming it to Batavia. You will probably know it best by its contemporary name, Jakarta, the capital of Indonesia today. From this new base of operations, the Dutch East India Company aggressively expanded its territory, taking over other Portuguese settlements and establishing new colonies on other Indonesian islands as well. In 1641, the Dutch once again cooperated with the Johor Sultanate to lay siege to the city of Malacca, the last stronghold of Portuguese power, and succeeded in extinguishing Portuguese influence. Feeling invincible, the Dutch East India Company made a play to push the Spanish Empire out of Southeast Asia as well. 5 years later, in 1646, they engaged the Spanish Navy in the Philippines. However, Lady Luck was no longer on their side. Despite having a larger force, the Dutch were defeated by the Spanish. They would not make another attempt at the Philippines again. Now, along with the Dutch East India Company, the English East India Company was rising in power too. Back in the early 1600s, ongoing conflicts with the Dutch and English were bleeding the Portuguese and Spanish coffers dry. Exploiting the waning Portuguese influence in Southeast Asia, the English East India Company also commissioned voyages to the Malay archipelago, establishing a few small trading posts in various parts of Indonesia. However, the English generally viewed the Indian Ocean as their main theatre of operations at the time, and were working to dislodge Portuguese presence from the region. Not much attention was devoted to Southeast Asia, and as a result, English colonial settlements in the Malay archipelago were not as proliferous as those of the Dutch. When English and Dutch powers far eclipsed Portuguese and Spanish powers, competition between the two over the Spice Strait intensified and erupted into a series of military conflicts that lasted from the mid-17th century to the late 18th century, known as the Anglo-Dutch Wars. During this time, crucial English colonies in the Malay archipelago were taken over by the Dutch, who were consolidating its control over the trading choke points in the Straits of Malacca and Sunda. The English, however, were unwilling to leave the lucrative spice trade in the region entirely in the hands of the Dutch. So, in the late 17th century, a fortified trading base was built on the southwestern coast of Sumatra, far enough from the Dutch power base of Batavia, but close enough to the spice trade so that they could still have some meat on the bone. This colony was named Bencoolen. For the next 100 years, the colonial situation in Southeast Asia remained pretty much a status quo, with the English controlling Bencoolen, the Dutch controlling most of Indonesia as well as Malacca, and the Spanish controlling the Philippines. In other parts of the world, these European powers continued to battle it out, competing one another over the sugar trade in the Americas and the slave trade in Africa. The year 1707 would see England and Scotland uniting under the same monarch, fashioning itself as Great Britain. However, the advent of the First Industrial Revolution in 1760 would reset the balance of power, bringing about a new and radically different world order. By the end of the 18th century, the British Empire would renew its interest in establishing a proper foothold in Southeast Asia. Before I close, I have a quick announcement to make. Unfortunately, my midterm assignments are starting to pile up really quickly, which means I will not have as much time to dedicate to the production of this podcast. I will let you know the dates for each successive episode until this all tides over and we can revert back to our old fortnightly schedule. For now, the next episode is scheduled for the 25th of October. I know, this may come as a disappointment to some of you who have been looking forward to upcoming episodes, but I will need more time to organize my research and update the entries on my website. I sincerely apologize. In the meantime, if you would like to connect with me, feel free to drop your questions or messages at marioteng.com. When we return on the 25th of October, we will finally return to the island of Singapore and commence the next phase of Singapore's history by welcoming the arrival of the British.